Identifying.
Let's go.
You're about to experience action like you've never heard it before. Action sports, celebrities, badasses, and massive interviews. All coming to you from the Polaris Razor Studio. This is Jim Beaver's Project Action, exclusively on Podcast One.
Welcome to Jim Beaver's Project Action here on the Podcast One Network, coming at you from the Polaris Razor Studio with one of your favorite shows on iTunes about celebrities, action sports, badasses, racing, and all things action. And today is not going to disappoint. We got Rick Roman Waugh on the show, the man behind the new movie coming out in theaters, Shot Caller. It's a movie about the prison system that stars Game of Thrones' Jaime Lannister. You know him as Jaime Lannister, the Kingslayer, but he's also goes by Nikolai Coster-Waldau. Hopefully I got that pronunciation right. I think I did. I think I nailed it. But anyways, an amazing movie. It's out on DirecTV right now, on demand. It hits theaters this week, and we've got the director and the writer, Rick Roman Waugh, on the show. An amazing talk about all kinds of things, as far as the action movie industry, this country, just a lot of cool stuff. I think you guys are really the prison system, what it's like to go behind bars. I mean, it's just an amazing interview. You guys are really going to love it. And I got to tell you, this show today, we're cutting to the chase. We're going straight to the interview because I am en route. As you listen to this, I will be there, but I got Vegas Torino, General Tire Vegas Torino going off this week, and I'm teaming with Travis Pastrana and Jolene Van Butte in the Polaris Razor Star Car. Videos to come, but that's going down. I'm racing this week, so I don't have time for news and a bunch of other stuff, so we're going to roll right into this Rick Roman Waugh interview. But before we do that, want to remind you guys, please rate, review, subscribe to Project Action on iTunes, and if you leave a review, if you leave your Twitter, Instagram, at username, I'll follow you back on social media. My promise to you, but please, I need those subscriptions, those ratings, reviews. It keeps this show going. It keeps this at your fingertips very easily. You can also listen to us through the brand new Podcast One app. It's an amazing new app. You guys should check that out. Or at downanddirtyshow.com, brand new renovated downanddirtyshow.com. All new website. You guys need to check that out. Or obviously iTunes, or the Podcast One website. So thanks to everybody who've tuned into that. Please tune into my other show, the Down and Dirty Radio Show, powered by Polaris Razor. We drop that on Tuesdays all the time on Podcast One, national syndication on Wednesdays. But, man, we got a lot to get to with Rick Roman Waugh today, and got to tell you about a couple of our amazing partners. Before we get to that, though, we got this new partner on board here, ZipRecruiter, and we talk a lot of marketing, we talk a lot of business, depending on who the guest is, and a lot of you are business owners, and you're hiring, but you don't know where to post your ad to get to find the best candidate for their job, right? Well, I'm telling you, with ZipRecruiter, you can post that job to 100-plus job sites with one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you, finds them for you. In fact, 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter gets a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails, no calls to the office. You simply screen, rate, manage the candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, I'm going to offer you a free trial. That's right. You can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Beaver, and it's free for you. That's right, ZipRecruiter.com/Beaver. One more time, try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/Beaver. And been an amazing partner. Definitely check out ZipRecruiter. You should also check out my friends at TrueCar. I am not only telling you about TrueCar, I actually use TrueCar, and it's changed the way that I buy new or used vehicles, and it's tough feeling comfortable that you're getting a fair price at a car dealer. You need pricing context, right? Information that empowers you so you feel confident. Well, with TrueCar, you'll see what other people in your area paid for the car you want. From there, you connect with a local TrueCar certified dealer and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want. They'll show you what people paid in your area for the same car that you want, so you'll know what price is fair and you'll feel confident. Once you register, you'll see pricing on actual inventory. It's competitive pricing offered to you only by a TrueCar certified dealer for an actual vehicle on their lot. It's pricing you'll see before going to that dealership, so you'll feel confident when you show up there. With TrueCar, you'll connect with a local certified dealer you're choosing, so you can enjoy a quick, easy buying experience. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with TrueCar certified dealers, and you'll save an average of over $3,000 off of MSRP at those TrueCar certified dealers. Have I told you that over 3 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users through that certified dealer network? And you realize there's over 13,000 TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. So when you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states. And you know, I also got to say, I got another partner, been with us a long time, also a user of their product. And all of us, we own cars, right? We do. And you know what? You own a car, you've got a to-do list. You got to drop off the dry cleaning. You got to pick up some milk. Here's an idea. Let's save hundreds of dollars on car insurance. And the good thing is you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. All you have to do, go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. Extra money in your pocket just may be the most rewarding thing that you do today. Yep. We got some amazing partners here on Project Action. TrueCar, Geico, ZipRecruiter. Make sure and go to ZipRecruiter.com/Beaver. But we also get amazing guests. That's right. Some of the best guests in the business, whether it be action sports, racing, celebrities, Hollywood, music. We are here. We're bringing it each and every week on Project Action. And this week, I am stoked, beyond stoked, to bring you an interview with Rick Roman Waugh from the new movie Shot Caller right after this.
Hey, I'm Jordan Rogers.
And I'm Luke Rogers.
And we're the hosts of Sports Related.
And we're brothers. We're going to bring the thunder. You're going to leave smarter. We're going to drop mind grenades. We're going to carpet bomb your brain with sports and culture. And if you're a guy, you're going to get in touch with your feminine side. If you're a girl, you're going to like sports. If you already like sports, you're going to know how to talk about sports. Even if you don't like sports, you're going to learn how to talk about sports. We're going to bring it, and we're going
to
bring it hard.
You're going to get to know us a little bit, too. The embarrassing background stories. Luke pooping his pants as a grown adult. Yep, it happened. I'll share it.
It's not a good story.
But join us, because we're going to give you something to take away every week. Remember to download new episodes every Friday at the Podcast One app, or subscribe to Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.
All right. I'd like to welcome Rick Roman Waugh to the show. Man, you know, I got to say, Rick, welcome to Project Action, first of all. But before we get into things, some big news coming out of your camp the past couple of weeks. I know we signed on to do this interview a couple of weeks ago, but looks like you got pegged as the director to the follow-up to Olympus's Fallen, Angel Has Fallen, man. That's got to be pretty exciting news for you.
Well, thank you, Jim. Yeah, you know, Gerard Butler and I have been looking to circle up and do something together. And, you know, what's going to be fun about Angel Has Fallen is it really takes a different trajectory than the previous two installments. You know, it's still Mike Banning and guarding the president, but there's a great twist coming of what is going to happen in that movie. And, you know, they're letting me put my stamp on it and kind of redefine the franchise in a way that hopefully, you know, gives it legs to have a major trajectory. But I'm really excited to finally work with, you know, with Jerry and, you know, and sink our teeth into a character and really add some complexity to the role.
Yeah, well, and you know, this is a, you know, I got to say, it's got to be pretty exciting for you, because I mean, this is a well-established franchise. I think both movies pulled close to $200 million worldwide. I mean, so they've got good box office, you know, and then you've got Morgan Freeman thrown in the mix as well. I mean, it's got to be really exciting, you know, for you to come into a franchise like this and, like you said, be able to put your stamp on it and kind of change the direction the whole thing goes.
Yeah, you know, it's a fine line, right? You know, there's a... You're right. The combined movies have done over $400 million. There's a huge fan base for this story and this franchise. So as much as I'm going to put my stamp on it, I'm also going to protect the integrity of things that the fans loved about the original two movies, and hopefully give it a new spin as well, to where we add on to it and push it a new direction.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of the thing, right? You know, after the first two movies, there comes a point where you've got to change things up a bit to keep things fresh and keep people interested, because you can't just rehash the old thing. So they bring in somebody like you. I mean, do you feel like there's any pressure on you, you know, coming into a position like this?
Oh, definitely. But I actually love it. You know, I like the pressure, because I feel like, you know, when I've got butterflies in my stomach and, you know, and there's anxiety and apprehension, those are good things. You know, maybe it's my stunt background that comes from, where you realize that you're pushing the envelope in the right way and that you're, you know, hopefully doing something exciting. If we feel comfortable with the things that we're going into, then maybe there's something that we shouldn't be doing in the first place. So I like pushing myself, Shock Collar is an example of that. It's the follow-up to my movie Felon, you know, and Snitch definitely falls into the same category as a trilogy about the prison system in America. So if you're going to do a third, you know, installment to, again, a trilogy of that nature, you hopefully you're doing something where you're pushing the envelope and inventing a new direction or a new storyline or a new point of view that doesn't feel repetitive and gives it a fresh take. So hopefully Angel Has Fallen will do the same thing, where it won't be a repeat of the previous two. It'll protect the integrity of things that people loved about it, but it gets spun in a whole new direction with a new style and tone to it, to where it does. It feels like it's a movie that stands on its own two legs and lives on its own trajectory, but again, represents the overall franchise.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's talk about your transition to writing and directing, because, I mean, I look down your filmography and I got to tell you, man, I mean, you look at some of these films and I go, you know, some of these are some iconic action films that, you know, you've been a part of, you know, and how did that transition happen? Is it hard to make that transition to directing? I mean, I know, you know, to a point you're still kind of making that transition, but, you know, how does that happen? Because, you know, I know me just, you know, trying to draw parallels in my business, you know what I mean? And I'm a professional race car driver, and now I've started moving into the commentary role on TV, and it's tough because they look at you as one thing and they don't really want to open that door to the other thing, you know, and it's really hard to get that to crack open regardless of how well you're known, you know. And how was that for you? I mean, because you were well established as a stunt person, but that transition to writing and directing, that had to have been pretty tough.
It is, you know, it's interesting, because when I made the transition, it was definitely not the flavor of the month, let's say. Yeah. I think that nowadays, you know, there's some new guys that are coming in from the stunt world, and people are actually looking at the people that come from that world can be provocative storytellers. You know, you've got, you know, Chad Stahelski and David Leitch and even my brother Scott. You know, we've got a lot of guys that are doing the action genre really, really well as directors. I'm kind of a different ilk, you know. I came up through the business in the stunt world. Our father, Fred Waugh, was one of the original, you know, members of Stunts Unlimited. And so I grew up with all of these guys. And when I was a very young kid on sets and, you know, could be staring at Clint Eastwood, but I didn't care who he was. I was looking at the stuntmen, you know, doing his action and, you know, falling off the horses and crashing cars and everything else. And they were my heroes. So it was kind of a natural progression for me to start in the stunt business at a very young age. And, you know, luckily, my dad had made a big position with me of, don't be the lazy guy that sits at the trailers, you know, playing cards, you know, find what you want to do in this business, because it's not going to be forever with stunts. And be on set and watch the process and learn, you know, and it'll make you a better, not only stunt player, but then a coordinator and action director and so forth. So, you know, I took that advice to heart, and I was very fortunate to work with some very, very talented directors. You know, I've worked with Spielberg and Richard Donner and John McTiernan, and, you know, the list goes on. And I also saw some of the train wrecks, you know, some of the directors that either got ran over by the cast or the producers, or vice versa, that were very harsh and brutal on people. And so I'd seen both sides of the equation, work and not work. And I used to sit on the set, and what I'd really watch is how the filmmakers would work. And I realized that the I didn't want to be in front of the camera. It wasn't really my cup of tea. So I knew acting and so forth wasn't really where I wanted to go. But I really liked the director position because I felt like you got to play in this sandbox and create things, you know, and I would try to develop my own voice with that and say, you know, God, I wouldn't think of doing it that way when they would, you know, when John McTiernan would set up a shot, or I would say I would have done it different. And it's not that I was right or wrong. It was just great proving ground where I was, again, developing my own voice. And then I got very fortunate to work with a man named Tony Scott for a number of movies. And he became a true mentor to me. Maybe not so much as my voice being like Tony's voice. God, I would love to be as talented as he was. But what I really watched was a man that treated people with respect, knew how to run a set, knew the filmmaking inside and out. He didn't have to rely on other people to do his job or how to tell him to do his job because he did his homework. He took it seriously, and he had a passion for it. And so if I've taken anything away from all of the very great filmmakers that I've been fortunate to work with, it was that, you know, that I learned that, you know, you got to roll up your sleeves in this business and not have an ego about it and go get your hands dirty and get into it. So, you know, to break out of stunts was a very, very difficult thing at the point when I was doing it. The funny story was I, you know, had transferred into commercials and was directing commercials and directing second units and so forth. And then, you know, they start sending you these scripts, and they had sent me this Getaway Driver movie, you know, the script for it. And it was just a god-awful script. And I was naive enough to think, God, I could just write one better myself. And thank God I was that naive and didn't realize how hard screenwriting is. I'd never written a screenplay before. But I had met these two guys in the business that were prolific screenwriters, and I'd called them and we'd work together. And I said, look, you know, I want to write a screenplay. I want to go to the school from a working writer's point of view. So if what I'm writing is crap, tell me why it's crap, you know, and be honest with me. And so I did about a year process with these guys that were great. And it's probably why I love to mentor writers now and help, you know, pass the torch along and, you know, and bring up new people. But I, you know, wasn't afraid to go to work with them. And that script went nowhere. But what had happened is I still loved the whole Getaway Driver arena. And I wrote a script called Hammer Down. And it was about a getaway driver. And it ended up selling to DreamWorks. And with Michael DeLuca, you know, who was first, you know, that became the president over there. And I launched in this new direction, you know, which was really interesting, Jim, because as much as I wanted to continue directing, I found a passion for writing, and I went on a writing tear for about 8 years and didn't direct anything, and was writing, studio movies all around town and working for all these guys that I used to be a stunt guy for. Now is, you know, writing movies for Jerry Bruckheimer and Neil Moritz and Mark Gordon and, you know, all these great big prolific action producers. And yeah, I got typecast of what does an ex-stuntman do well? He does action well. So then suddenly I was writing the bigger, faster, more expensive movies. You know, everything that was how much bigger can the explosion be? How much bigger can the action be? What's the unique angle of it? And to be honest with you, I was getting kind of disheartened because it wasn't really the movies that I loved growing up. You know, I grew up loving the Sidley Lumet movies. You know, the movies that had some type of social relevancy to them, that had something to say. You know, it wasn't a message-driven movie beating you over the head, but you walked out of the theater after being entertained, and you were talking about the issues that the movie presented. And I'd met a producer along the way named Tucker Tooley, and he and I became close friends. And I said, you know, I really want to make a transition in my career and start, and you know, basically my real directing debut of what the movies that I want to make. And I said, you know, it's funny, everybody asks a former stuntman what he's afraid of. And, you know, and my patent answer, which is the truth, is if you're afraid of it in the stunt world, then you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. But the one thing I am fearful of is going to prison. You know, I said, I've heard all the cliches and the stereotypes of rape the first day and stab this and this and that. And I said, you know, I'd love to make a movie that's kind of an everyman's movie of, you know, you make that one mistake or you defend your household and you realize it's not in self-defense and you have to go do prison time. What would it be to survive that journey? So I said, I'll do all the research and everything else. And, you know, go down this rabbit hole. And we agreed, but it was funny because at first it was supposed to be only like, I said, I could probably do this research in 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Well, what I figured out is that when I wanted to go into the institutions, the Department of Corrections in California were absolutely against that. They had a lot of scandals at that time, and they didn't want any filmmakers or press near their places. So I thought of a different angle, and I became a volunteer with the Department of Corrections working in parole. And nobody knew I was a filmmaker. They all thought I was a rookie cop, you know, or trying to come up the ranks to actually be a full validated parole agent. And so it allowed me this firsthand view with unflinching honesty of how the system works. And in parole, you get to go inside the prisons and, you know, and see how the gangs work and see how the inmates work and see how the guards work, the whole subculture of prison, what's really the hierarchy, how things really happen in there. And then you also get to see the streets with parole, about what happens when guys get up back out on the streets, or, you know, why is the recidivism rate so high in our country? And so Felon was born off of that. And it was really a new launching pad for me in a different direction, where I could do the thrills and I can give you some action, but I was giving you a dramatic film that hopefully you related to, that was centered, that was grounded, that had a lot of authenticity. And it launched me in this new direction, Jim, that I'm really excited about the films that I'm making now. Even to the point of Angel Has Fallen next, it will be dealing with some hot button issues that I don't want to discuss here, but there will be a social relevancy to the journey that Mike Banning is on in that franchise, you know, Gerard Butler's character, and what Morgan Freeman's character is dealing with as a president. So I'm always looking for that inside tract of controversy, hot button issue, something that can be topical, something that can create debate and discussion, not necessarily solve the problem, but open up debate about it and then entertain people at the same time. So that's kind of the long-winded version of my journey. It was a very unorthodox way of going about it. Most guys, you know, get a commercial reel together and then they start peddling their wares around to try to get a movie. I was very fortunate to grow up loving literature and English, you know, and read a lot. And so it became a natural thing for me to be a storyteller first on the page and then build up my wares in that way to reinvent myself as a filmmaker, you know, all around.
Yeah, one, and, you know, I think one of the things that caught me with Shot Caller, with watching this, and I kind of went in with the open expectations, you know, and you know, we've seen so many prison movies and things like that, you know, it's like you never know what's real and what's fake. But there was something about this movie that was so raw, and, you know, and I'm kind of like you. One thing that scares me would be going to prison, you know, and I've always thought about that. It's like, if I was put into that situation, how would it go? You know, and a lot of people want to think, oh, I'd be the good guy, I wouldn't get involved in that. But I think there's a point where you go into prison and you've got a split second decision to make. You know, it's like, you know, it's, you know, you're either going to be the prey or you're going to be the predator, you know? And
yeah.
I think, you know, that's what caught me about this. I mean, it was so raw and it was so real, and you could tell that you had immersed yourself into this world because everything about it, I mean, it was just so vivid, and that's what really caught me about this movie.
Thank you. You know, what happened is after being 2 years as a volunteer parole agent, you know, it really opened my eyes to the system as a whole. And what it also allowed me to do is to really break down and dispel a lot of the cliches and stereotypes of what prison is, you know, and what would happen to you and how the gangs work and how the system itself works and how everybody gets coerced in that system one way or the other. And so, you know, if you've seen Felon, you know, that movie's an insular journey of a man's survival inside, but really didn't deal with the outside world as much. But I really wanted to make a counterpoint to that film, where it was a different storyline, a different hero or different protagonist going through the exact same system. Not only what would you have to do to survive that system, what would be the moral cost to your own self of in surviving that system, but what happened if you did and you made it back outside? Would your life go back together again? Would you be the same man that you were when you went in? really trying to understand and get people to understand why the recidivism rate is so high in our country. And I think there's a misnomer that these individuals get out of prison and then they end up back in their same neighborhoods, and it's the pressure of the neighborhood that they fall prey to. There's a part of that. But the bigger issue that we're having, and I'm not here to defend criminals, that's for sure. If you do the crime, you should be doing the time. But what's happened is we've created a world now in these prisons where violence is breeding violence, and inmates are coming out as uber gangsters, you know, from Gladiator School, and then they're hitting the streets, and their minds have been rewired to a different way of life and a different moral code that doesn't fit into society anymore. And so they operate by a different set of rules, and unfortunately those rules get them in trouble because they're either hurting somebody or they're doing things that are illegal, and the next thing you know, they're back inside again, and they almost feel like they've gone home. You know, it were a place where they felt more comfortable in the first place. So there's this really bad cycle that's happening. I don't know what the answer is to prison reform. Hopefully Shot Caller shows you both facets of that, of how violence is breeding violence inside of our prisons. You know, there was this interesting comment was made that, you know, it's hard to believe that somebody like Nikolai Coster-Waldau's character, who was a law-abiding citizen, had no priors at all, would go in for DUI manslaughter, ended up with, you know, all the big boys, you know, with all the violent crimes. And it makes you shake your head because you realize how naive people are. Yeah, that's 100% true. You know, a violent crime is a violent crime, and you are going to be cast with them. And so suddenly you go in from, when you're, like you said, Jim, it's, you know, you're either going to be a warrior or you're going to be a victim, and they don't give you any other choice. And so you pick your path. It's by that fight or flight mechanism inside of us. You are either going to fight, and if you do the way that Nick's character does, well, they've got things for you to do, you know, and that's a trajectory that's got its own danger to your, you know, to your integrity, morality, and your own survival and health. But also, if you decided that fighting is not for you and became a victim, if anybody thinks that you're only going to get raped one day or only beaten one day, well, you got another thing coming, because that's a slippery slope that never stops either. So you kind of realize that the primal nature of what happens inside here, inside these institutions, and what you have to do to survive, how that alters your mind. And now you put that individual back on the streets with no programs, nothing to help them reintegrate back into society. And the crappy part about that is that there's a number of these guys that don't want to program. They don't want to go to help themselves. They are just who they are now. And I don't know how you help them. But there are ones that do want to do it right, that do want to get into substance abuse programs, that do want other programs to help them understand how to get a job, how to deal with society again. And, you know, hopefully we can create more of those, that we take some of the burden off of our prison system that is just so overcrowded. It doesn't matter what state you live in.
Yeah. Well, and I think you touched on a lot of issues too. I mean, you know, even with Nikolai, he did such a tremendous job, at, you know, in his role, but you know, he was torn. You know, there was a guy there that was torn because he really wanted to do the right thing and do right by his family. And in the end, it was distancing himself from him because he got in so deep, but he had to end up ultimately even attempting to get back to his family. And to me, there was just so many layers there. And I think that's what's interesting, you know, and I can only see, you know, when these actual people do get out of prison, you know, there's so many layers there and there's strings tying them back to prison that maybe nobody even know about, you know, but they're there, and there can be threats on them or their family or their loved ones. And it's such an interesting dynamic, you know, and I think there's a lot at play that, you know, people on the outside, you just look at it and it's not a black and white thing. There's so many different things in play.
For sure. I mean, the first thing that people have to understand, a number of guards have said this to me in their own versions, but basically they might control the gates and the doors, but the gangs run the prisons. I've never met a guard that said otherwise. So you have to understand then, if that's the case, when you are released into society and you decided to become a warrior to defend yourself, to survive, some people, it's not just for survival. They relish in the power of it. There's a lot of power that comes to inflicting harm on others if you didn't have power in the first place. So there's a lot of different facets to that. But there's an agenda that's given to you when you get released back into society to do their bidding, you know, to report back to them, to handle stuff in your areas. So it's a never ending cycle that happens. So yeah, it's people don't realize that, you know, John Doe comes back out into the neighborhood or into society, that suddenly everything that happened to him inside that prison should just be left behind. People don't realize the tentacles that are still holding on to that guy, and what he's having to deal with the pressures that are coming from within the prison. And then on top of that, which is one part of the movie that I think is really important, is when, you know, Jeffrey Donovan's character Bottles talks about, you know, you wonder what your family is going to think of you when you do these things. You wonder about all these things, but then you realize the only thing that matters is you getting back to them. Well, yeah, that's what the gangs want you to know, but that now is weighing on your head. Are you damaged goods? Are you going to bring the black cloud that is following you back upon your family members? So I think there's so many different complexities to it that, you know, it's to pivot for a second, it's there's a similar thing that I think that where people have a bad habit of kind of globalizing an issue. And what I'm talking about is like post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
I did a documentary called That Which I Love Destroys Me, and it follows a Delta Force operator who was blown up in battle. I mean, here's the guy working at the tip of our military spear, and he sustained significant injuries to the point that he was out, and he was suddenly back into society, and he had no idea how to even deal with society. He lived by a different set of rules. His brain was rewired to war. And, you know, his version of post-traumatic stress is very different than others. And so what I learned on that journey is that post-traumatic stress is an individual thing. It is categorized by who the individual is, the situations that they have dealt with, the history of their upbringing. I mean, there's so many different facets to it. And I think that when you talk about prison reform, we have to stop the exact same mistake of globalizing prison reform, globalizing that every inmate's situation, experience is the same. It's not. It's extremely individual, you know, of, again, everything from upbringing, who they are as a person, the crime that they committed, where they were incarcerated, what that incarceration was about. I mean, it's just so many different facets to it. So it's a much harder thing to deal with. To sit there and put your, you know, pinpoint, you know, but I think it's important for us to start taking a step back and realizing that every individual coming out of prison is the same as every soldier or somebody dealing with post-traumatic stress. It's an individual thing that we have to address as them as an individual, not as a globalized issue.
Yeah, there's no one-size-fits-all approach to any of these issues. I mean, it's a highly, you know, specialized, you know, with each person, you know, and I completely agree with that. You know, I think everybody thinks there's just you just do one blanket thing and it fixes everything. And like you said, everybody's got different life experiences and experience different things. And it's a highly individualized, you know, journey out of that.
But, yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
Yeah, no, all the guys that I've met, you know, that have, you know, there were real major shot caller prison gangsters that I had meet with the cast. You know, Nick, I took Nick into a number of institutions to understand what that tension and that culture felt like, that energy. You know, it's like nothing you've ever experienced unless you've really been inside. The atmosphere is such a subculture unto itself. I'll never forget when I did Felon, you know, my wife came into town and we just had our twin sons. So she had been with them for the first part and then came to see me in New Mexico. And I said to her, you know, we're going to go film right now in the old main prison here in Santa Fe. There's four new prisons and I drive by them every single day for the last 2.5 months. And I can't stop thinking about that. Like that window, take that window, for example, up there on the top left, there could be somebody that's been in that exact same window for the last 15 years of his life that had never seen anything else. So, and we have no idea what happens inside that window or what happens inside that building. And it's really that way when you step inside a prison. It's a subculture unto itself. And each one is very different. They all feel different. But, you know, the individuals that I met have done time, they say the same thing, but they also become into a routine, and there's so many cliches that are absolutely dead wrong about how people are dealt with in prison. One is, I think that a lot of the cast members were shocked about how respectful, without any kind of profanity used, and how frank a lot of the major shot callers they talked to were, you know, that they weren't the cliche guy talking smack and, you know, cursing up a storm and puffing up his chest and acting like he was, you know, the badass and I did this and that. They were very, very shocked. And then what they realized that there's one commodity that's left to a human being when they get inside, and it's respect. And so when you hear about people being injured or killed or raped or whatever it may be, I can guarantee you it was a moment of disrespect that triggered that. It was either the disrespect that you didn't look them in the eye when you should have, or you looked them in the eye when you shouldn't have. It could be the moment of not paying respect to somebody when you walked in, or they see you as a potential victim, so they've lost the respect for you as somebody that's a warrior. So that has its own connotations. So it's the last thing that we have as a human being that they hold on to very sacredly, is that right there. So it's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to me how prison strips away all of the vanity, all of the material things of the world, and it becomes into a very primal setting of right and wrong, respect, disrespect, things that should be our center. Well, it strips everything away that's the only center you've got left.
Yeah. Well, and how was filming? I mean, because I know you guys filmed you did this entire movie in at least the prison settings in 24 days, I think it was. And you were on location there in New Mexico. I mean, how was that? That had to have been a really fast, expedited process.
Yeah, no, we did the entire movie in 24 days, and it was a blitzkrieg shoot for sure. Dana Gonzalez, you know, my partner in crime that I've been filming with for last 10 years, you know, we know each other so well that, you know, we knew that we were going to swing for the fences on this movie, but we also had a really good plan of attack. And, you know, one of the things that was part of that plan of attack is I don't like movie sets, meaning I don't like sound stages and things fake, because I feel like when you start putting actors into that environment and you're trying to do something authentic, how can you be authentic in something that's not authentic? So we shot in all the real institutions. You know, we shot in several live institutions that were active at the time. And then you have to plan accordingly. You know, you have to know that they have jobs to do. And so that means that you are going to be scrutinized as security. The crew is going to be scrutinized. It's going to be harder to get the equipment in and things like that. But if you treat them with respect and you let them know that you're not going to make their world a nightmare and that you're going to respect what they do, they bend over backwards and help you. But you have to plan accordingly and say, you know what, it's not going to take me 15 minutes to go grab a light off a truck and get that light in here. It could take an hour and a half because it's going to have to go check through security. So you plan your day to the way that the prison works, not the way that you think you work. And then, you know, we had another, but there's the other institution that we use, which is the old main prison in Santa Fe. We shot in there because we can design things inside to show what these new modern prisons look like the security housing units. There are no security housing units to film in right now because they're all filled up. So we had to create our own security housing unit within, but we did it inside a real prison and then switched all the doors, switched all the security, switched all the colors, and showed you what it looks like, which is where the movie starts out at, where you're meeting Jacob Money Harlan for the first time as he's being released back into society. Well, he's coming out of the security housing unit, which is the prison within the prison. It's where all the biggest validated gangsters go and the highest disciplinary problems. And so there was all different levels of incarceration that we were going to go through. So we used a number of prisons to do that. And then where we knew we wouldn't get the existing location because of overcrowding, because we wouldn't physically have access to it, then we created those within the old main prison.
Yeah, it's I just got to tell you, I mean, this is one of those films. I mean, I watch a lot of movies and I travel a lot. So I'm always, you know, I'm always watching movies, killing time on flights and things like that. And there was just something about this movie. It's one of the best movies I've seen in a long, long time. And I got to ask you, I mean, you are, you know, you're a guy and obviously, you know, you're neck deep in Hollywood, but from what I understand, you live in Texas, right? I mean, that's got to be, how is that for you? I mean, because most people would live in Southern California. You living in Texas, I mean, do you feel like that's kind of gave you a breath of fresh air because it gives you a different outlook on things because you're not, you know, there in the middle of, you know, I don't know, you know, I guess I don't want to say the swamp that is Hollywood, but, you know, do you feel like it's given you a breath of fresh air being in Texas and kind of, you know, having that different view on everything?
Yeah, I mean, one, I grew up in the country, you know, and I grew up around area where there are real people and it wasn't about the materialism of things and so forth. So as much as I grew up a part of the movie and the film community, I didn't grow up a part of the Hollywood scene per se. And so, you know, now as a working filmmaker, it becomes difficult to separate the two when you live there because you just suddenly get consumed in the 24/7 of that culture itself. And that's just not who I am. It doesn't mean that I'm better or worse. It just means that I kind of understood that I really wanted to find a balance in my life. And you're right, get an outside point of view of and tap into really what's going on in America and our culture where we're around much more kind of grounded blue collar real people. And so love living here in Texas. I wanted my boys to have the same life that I had growing up, you know, and where they can go up the street to the park and play with real kids and that aren't Hollywood kids or movie producers kids or movie star kids. And again, for me, it was a conscious choice, but it also allows me to really just concentrate on the work, you know, so that when I'm getting up and I'm sitting down at my computer to write, and I write every single day, you know, it's just the job that I love, and I'm picking stories now that I can't wait to tear into. I think the one thing that I learned in my writing career before Fallon was I was getting to a point where I had lost the passion for the films that I was doing or the stories that I was telling, and they became about the almighty paycheck. And it's a dangerous slope to be on because, yeah, you're making great money, but your work suffers because you don't have the passion behind it anymore. And it's hard as hell enough to go sit in front of a computer that's where the screen is blank and start filling those pages up where 120 pages later, it's a movie that somebody wants to spend millions and millions of dollars on. So there's, for me, I'm at a place now in my career and at my life where I'm excited about my life. I'm excited about how the lifestyle we have here in Texas. And I'm excited to sit in front of that computer and tell the stories that I can't wait to make next and not worry about the monetary side of it as much, but worry more about the substance part of it, you know, and that hopefully create a legacy that, you know, I'll be proud of.
Yeah, well, I think that's sounds like you definitely are on your way to that. So a little bit more on Shot Caller. I know I saw DirecTV is running some it's available on demand to rent right now. But when does this hit theaters?
Yeah, it's been a great experience working with DirecTV on this. You know, movies at this size, you know, in the competition we have today with these huge franchises like the Marvel movies and so forth and the studio machines, when you're not in that machine and you don't have $30, $40, $50 million, not even just to make your movie, forget that part, just to market your movie, how do you cut through that? How do you get people to recognize and see the film that you made? And so what's great is DirecTV really embraced this film in a way where we were able to get it into 25 million households to start spreading the message and spreading it out there of hopefully getting word of mouth of people seeing the film and getting their eyes on it. And then, you know, talking about it on social media and talking to about friends. So the awareness has been great. So now we get to really expand out wide because obviously not everybody has DirecTV. So on August 18th, next Friday, we will be out in a number of cities theatrically across America. And it will go out also wide on VOD so that we can really get it out even further to the masses. So for me, I'm thrilled with the platform of how it's being released through Saban Films because we get a lot of eyeballs on the movie and start talking about it. And hopefully people are entertained and coming out and asking questions, you know, about their own lives and how do they not fall into the same pitfalls as Jacob Harlan does in this movie, but also just thinking about the prison system as a whole. You know, how do we help ourselves as a society and stop pointing the fingers at all the politicians and the government officials? How do we get involved to kind of start course correcting some of the things that are happening?
Yeah, well, I think you timed it just right. I mean, I'm a big Game of Thrones fan, right? So we're all sitting here wondering if Nikolai, you know, aka Jamie Lannister, is dead, and here he's dropping, you know, in this movie Shot Caller next week. I think it was pretty good timing on your part. I don't know that you planned it that way, but I gotta say, man, it's I guess it's probably a good week to be Nikolai, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not bad having the Kingslayer, you know, inside prison now as the new Shot Caller.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's you know, I think that the bigger thing that I should emphasize as far as being lucky is just to be working with Nick, period. He's been an absolute professional and gentleman on this entire endeavor, and what a talent. You know, it was a very hard role to cast, to find somebody that can play both, let's call them, they're really different men, right?
Yeah.
On the evolution of this character, where they're at first starting out as a white collar person, that maybe you aren't a white collar, maybe you're blue collar, but we relate to Jacob because he's got a great family and he's got a great life and he's doing everything by the book and he's, you know, trying not to bend the rules, and yet he makes that one mistake that we're all a little bit guilty of, and it doesn't even have to be with substances, you know, of alcohol or whatever else. It could be looking down at that phone for texting. It could not even be in a car. It could be the other little things that we bend the rules on that we don't realize can bite us in the ass. And then to watch that evolution of that person that we can relate to become this scary individual of money, you know, this prison gangster, and to be, one, shocked by it, but also believe that this person could become that person. So to have somebody that can play a range that far, you know, Nick just was the perfect choice. And so I was very blessed that he wanted to come aboard and tear into this. So yeah, I'll take the Game of Thrones heat. I'll take all of it. But the most important part of it to me is Nikolai.
Yeah, no, he was tremendous. You did a tremendous job directing and writing this one. Big fan of it. I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. Excited to, you know, see how this thing does once it hits theaters and obviously on DirecTV. And man, we'll have to catch up again when you have Angel Has Fallen in the works.
I would love that, Jim. Thank you for giving me some time with you.
All right, thanks a lot, my friend.
All right, we'll speak soon.
All right, you too. Awesome catching up with Rick Roman Waugh. Make sure and check out Shot Caller in theaters, dropping this week, and check it out on DirecTV On Demand if you don't like feeling like going to the cinema. But Rick Roman Waugh, a complete badass. Definitely follow him on social media. Changing the game. He's worked with some amazing actors. I mean, The Rock, Val Kilmer. I mean, he's just super talented. Obviously, you know, we talked about Nikolai Coster-Waldau, you know, just some amazing talented actors. This guy, I mean, he's a legend in his own right in stunt circles. Just a great guy with, you know, with an awesome outlook on the industry. But awesome catching up with him. Thank you guys for tuning in. I know, you know, kind of keeping it short and sweet this week. You know, awesome interview, but not a whole lot of other stuff. All killer, no filler this week. please, you know, rate, review, subscribe to Project Action on iTunes. Check out the Down and Dirty Radio Show, my other show, available just about anywhere. Check out the new renovated Down and Dirty Show.com. Make sure and give me a follow at JimBeaver15 on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and watch my shenanigans on social media this week. Be watching for the videos and all the content pumped out. I got Travis Pastrana, Jolene Van Butte teaming up with me in the Polaris Razor Star Car at Vegas to Reno. It's going to be off the darn chain. I can promise you that. And if you're in the Vegas area, make sure and come out, check us out. We'd love to see you, love to meet you, love to have who knows, have a beer with you, who knows. We're racing though, but it's gonna be a good time. Thanks to all you guys for tuning in. Be safe, see you next week. As always, game on.